Over the last 40 years, few comedians have been a part of so many iconic, beloved projects than Larry Charles. Larry was one of the original writers and producers of the first five seasons of Seinfeld. He executive produced both Curb Your Enthusiasm and Entourage while directing 18 episodes of Curb and served as the showrunner for Mad About You. His film directing credits include Borat, Bruno, and The Dictator, as well as the documentary Religious with Bill Maher and Masked and Anonymous with Bob Dylan. Larry Charles writes about these 40 years of blood, guts, and laughter in his new memoir, Comedy Samurai, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Larry Charles to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. A delight.
Thank you for having me.
So at what point did you think it was time to tell your story, to tell about those four decades?
Well, you know, I have to say I've been keeping, I don't know why exactly, but ever since I was a child, I've been sort of keeping notes on my life for whatever purposes, stories, or I had no real kind of plan, but I liked the idea of having all that available, accumulating all that material. And I also have a pretty good memory and tend to remember things that a lot of other people who've experienced them with me have forgotten. And then the pandemic came along, and I couldn't really do any TV or film work for the most part. And I started to just write the book and wound up writing a 1,000-page book originally. Very, very long book that started from the beginning of my life to recently. And I gave it to my agent, and we gave it to publishers, and they all seemed to be very excited about it, but said, we can't do a 1,000-page book. So at that point, it was like either cutting each chapter down and kind of sanitizing it a little bit, or making a kind of a big decision. And I cut the book in half, essentially, with the thought that the childhood part, the early part of my life, which is also surreal and volatile and comical, that would be a separate book that will come later. And publishing this book now, which is basically the history of my professional life.
At what point, let's say, were you in your life where you decided that you had an idea of what you wanted your professional life to look like?
I'm still figuring that out, Joe. I never really had a kind of clear-cut. My initial feelings was, boy, wouldn't it be great? You know, I was from Brooklyn. You know, my father was a failed comedian and actor. You know, I said, wouldn't it be great to be involved in show business in some way? You know, but I couldn't figure out how to do it, really. In those days, there was not any kind of path for someone like me to take. You would sort of stumble around and maybe get lucky, which is basically what happened to me. But I was a cartoonist. I was a writer. I wrote stories. I had read about people like Woody Allen who used to sell jokes to comedians. And I thought that might be a way in. I think I could sell jokes, maybe submit them to comedians, maybe get involved somehow in show business that way. That's basically, I started off really writing for Screw magazine, to tell you the truth. I had a friend who used to collect porno. And when we'd hang out, I would look at the porno and I go, wow, the humor in the porno magazines is really weak. I think I could do better. And I wrote a couple of funny porno stories and sold them. And I was suddenly a published author. And then I wrote a porno novel, you know, and I was still a teenager at that point, you know. It gave me the confidence in my writing abilities to maybe go into a more mainstream aspect of it, and started writing humor in general, prose humor, and then eventually when I came out to California, writing jokes and trying to sell them.
When you were out there selling jokes, for you, the big break, like the time where you said, okay, now I have a gig, when was that?
Well, I had a couple of moments like that, and as I talk about in the book, I burned a lot of bridges, I blew a lot of opportunities, and I paid the price for them. When I was still like 19 years old, I stood in front of the Comedy Store with handwritten jokes. I didn't have a typewriter. It was really pre-computer. And I sold a joke to Jay Leno. and who was then, he and David Letterman were the big comedians at the Comedy Store at the time in the late 70s. Richard Pryor was there, Robin Williams. It was really a kind of a golden age of stand-up at that time. And I thought, that's going to get me on the path. But I was making $10 a joke. It wasn't, I couldn't make a sustain a living at it at that point. And so I was still parking cars and doing jobs like that, you know. So then a year went by. I went back to New York. I came back to LA. I was a bellhop. I did all kinds of things. And another comedian that I wrote for got cast on a TV show, which was Fridays.
Oh, yeah.
And he recommended me. Even though he hadn't seen me for a year, he liked my writing, recommended me. I happened to come back in time to California, and I was able to get an interview with the producers and get that job. That was probably my big break.
And that's Larry David, right?
That's where I meet Larry David and Michael Richards.
And when you're on that show, and many of us look at that show as very fondly and a very, very funny program, and still so of what came out of that.
I think the problem with Fridays, in terms of perception more than reality, was that it was called Fridays, you know? It was, which the writers were aghast. The producers had come to us and said, come up with a name for the show. We don't want to be thought of as a Saturday Night Live ripoff. So the writers, being all a bunch of young guys and women, we came up with crazy names for the show, very Monty Python-esque names. And we thought, this show's going to be radical. It's going to be a departure. Nobody's going to mistake it for Saturday Night Live. And then one day we came into work, and the binders and the jackets and the stationery all said Fridays on it. And we were all really disappointed that they had chosen that without really consulting us. And I think from that moment, it was like an uphill battle to establish ourselves as something other than a Saturday Night Live ripoff. And none of us felt that way. None of us wanted to be perceived that way. And we all worked really hard to sort of create a separate identity for the show.
Talk a little bit about the relationship you have with Larry David professionally, in the sense that, so after that, then he gives you a job as a writer on Seinfeld. And then, of course, you worked with him on Curb Your Enthusiasm. But even as Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld are working on Seinfeld, you're really the second in command during all of this as the person who is also realizing the vision of the show.
Well, Larry, first of all, on Fridays, he's older than I am, and more kind of like, he knew himself better than I did. I was still flailing when I got the job on Fridays. I mean, being a professional writer was not something I had any experience in. So he was always a mentor, always like a big brother, always kind of looked out for me. We're from the same neighborhood. That really helped a lot also. But after Fridays, we sort of stumbled through for quite a while, quite a number of years, before he hooked up with Jerry and started doing Seinfeld. I was just his choice to, he knew my sense of humor, he knew my work ethic, he knew my value system. And so he came to me and said, why don't you come and work on the show? It's probably going to get canceled. We'll make a little bit of money. We'll do what we want. We'll do a funny show, and we'll see what happens. And that's how Seinfeld happened for me. And then later, with Curb, he had seen me on Seinfeld be so visual. Larry didn't really have any interest in the visuals, in blocking and things like that. It wasn't really like a priority for him as much as the material was. And so I would stand with him at the rehearsals and go, you know, it'd be good to have a close-up here, or we should be seeing Elaine say this line, whatever that might be. So when he did Curb, he literally off the cuff said to me, you know, you should direct one of these. And I said, yes. And that's how I became a director. So his impact on my life cannot be measured. You know, I mean, he had a tremendous influence over my adult life, almost more than anybody else, I would say.
How did you feel when you started to direct of the change of that you could still be funny, that you could still bring out the humor, but you were behind the camera?
Well, it's a really different experience. You do it to some degree to protect the writing, you know? And I thought of myself up until that point as a writer or a producer or a showrunner. which has a lot of overlap with the director. The main differences for me as I look at it these days is writing is a very solitary experience, you know? And there's something that I really cherish about the solitary nature of writing. Directing is a very social job. You have to interact with a lot of people. You have to have a lot of answers. You have to face a lot of challenges, and it's very public. And I think it's like almost a personality thing for me. I have like these two sides of my personality, the side that wants to be alone and quiet and think and write, and the part of me that wants the action and the exhilaration of directing. That is also something very special and unique. I try to maintain my comedic sensibility in both realms.
When you talk about that in the book, you say, what was me? Perhaps I was meant to wander, a comedy samurai, going from show to show, project to project, saving them with my mind and my pen, and then moving on. I had started to romanticize, or at least delude myself, with this comedy samurai label. I certainly understand what you mean there, but that ain't too bad, is it?
No, it wasn't. I think, you know, the thing is, you're defined in show business by the things that get produced, by your body of work. You're not defined by the things that don't get produced, which often reflect you much more personally than the things you do get produced. And I've written and even directed movies. I've done a lot of stuff that hasn't really been seen by the public, that I would say, if you saw that in the context of my body of work, it would give you a much better sense of me. So my body of work is very much about me applying my sensibility, my thought, my values to the projects that I worked on, trying to make them as great as possible, even though they might be somebody else's project, and then moving on to the next thing. And the samurai, you know, that analogy seemed very apt to me.
When you left after leaving Seinfeld and then leaving, and then you go to Mad About You, and you're working on that show, but there is that, and you write about this, just that feeling of, okay, I've been at this party long enough and it's time to go.
Yeah, I'm kind of a gambler at heart. I'm not a careerist. I wasn't thinking in terms of career. I still don't. I think of myself as just doing cool things and being very lucky. When I reached that point on Seinfeld where I just was like tired of writing those stories and I felt that I had hit the glass ceiling there, I wanted to move on. I could have stayed longer. I could have stayed forever probably, but I wanted a new challenges in that samurai sort of fashion. And Mad About You presented me with a completely different, I'm a very eclectic person, and Mad About You presented me with a very different challenge, which was not to be the funniest, but to find emotion, to find reality, to find that kind of truth in a 30-minute comedy TV show. And that appealed to me. That was reflecting where I was at, where my marriage was at, where my personal life was at that time also.
I was struck in the book about you writing about also getting the opportunity to work with Mel Brooks. In fact, the episode that he was in got an Emmy. That must have been an amazing experience.
It was. I can't emphasize enough how important Mel Brooks has been in my comedic professional life. And as a person, he is a great inspiration as well. He's a very, very sweet and generous man, as well as being about the funniest person in the world. And the dream, I would never have dreamed, my dad would never have dreamed of having any personal encounter with Mel Brooks, let alone a professional relationship. So the idea of sitting at the table with him when Paul and Vic Levin and Billy Grunfest and I sat at the table with Mel and wrote together, you know, you'd have to step back. You'd have to step outside yourself and go, this is the guy who created the 2,000-year-old man and Blazing Saddles and, you know, sat with the writers on Sid Caesar. It was like, it was a surreal experience that I always go back to and think about. And then I had the great pleasure of directing him for an entire season on Curb as well. And we got even closer after that.
And which was a great season, and having to do with the producers, of course. You write about your time on Entourage, and it seems that that was a project that just never really, you never really connected with.
Well, I connected with it, but I was in the middle of a lot of other stuff at the time. I thought the show was great. I thought that Doug and Steve, the producers and the actors, were all really great. I understood the show really innately, the idea of being from, you know, Long Island or Brooklyn as I was, and coming out here and being almost like aliens and trying to fit into this show business world, but maintaining your own identities. I got all that really, really innately. And so I really loved the show, but I was doing Curb at the same time. My marriage was falling apart. I had other ambitions that I was not realizing that were frustrating me. And so I was in a kind of a whirlwind at that time. And again, with Entourage, like a lot of these shows and this samurai kind of concept, I knew that I could get the show to become a hit. I had confidence that the show could be a hit, but I didn't have the desire to stay with the show and follow it through to the end. I wanted to move on to something else.
And there weren't really the directing opportunities there for you that there were in the other shows.
Yeah, and in a way that wound up being a blessing in disguise, because I think if I had been allowed to direct the Entourages, which was the promise that was made to me, part of the promise of working on Entourage was I would get a chance to direct. And if I had done that, I might have stayed and might not have had some of the other experiences that I would have had.
You have a line in the book: I had gone from directing one episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm to directing Bob Dylan and an all-star cast in Masked and Anonymous. I mean, that in and of itself is amazing as to of just doing that, much less how it came about.
Yeah, that I was, again, these are very kind of lucky, serendipitous kind of moments in my life. You know, Bob had wanted to do this comedy show originally, and we met, and I thought, I'll have one meeting with Bob Dylan and that'll be exciting, and I could tell all my friends I met Bob Dylan. And that was all I really, that was my entire expectation for that. And then we hit it off and we started talking, and we kind of developed this half hour comedy show, which, as surreal as it sounds, that's how surreal the show itself was. And then he decided he didn't want to do that. And then my agents, my managers all thought I should bail at that point and get away, because he was too unpredictable. And I said, I'm on the Bob Dylan train. I'm taking this to the last stop. I want to see where this goes. And we wound up writing the script that became Masked and Anonymous. And during the course of writing the script, I would leave every day at the end of the day of writing and think, I really want to direct this, but how can I ask Bob Dylan to direct, you know, everybody's going to want to direct this movie, you know? And one day I just finally, you know, just got the courage and said, Bob, you know, I really think I'd be the best person to direct this movie. And he literally said, oh, okay. And that was it. I was directing that movie. And from then I had to take it very seriously. So I took a big leap from one episode of Curb to a big movie with all those major actors in it.
Larry Charles is our guest. The name of the book is Comedy Samurai. I'm interested in your working with Sacha Baron Cohen and on those projects, because the outrage of that and the incredible things that were done that were unbelievable, it's one thing for Sasha to be in those situations, but you're the one watching it and setting it up and making sure it actually works. And I assume at some point the one who has to be left with whatever carnage is left behind.
Yes, that is true. Yeah, the aftermath of those scenes, the first thing that happens when those scenes are over is that Sasha is whisked into a van and driven away. And so I am often left with a very angry person who I have to talk off a ledge, or, you know, ask them to put down their weapon so they don't hurt somebody. The challenge of making a movie like Borat is that it's not like you don't start the day or end the day or take lunch, or, you know, you don't do things. You are on, you're making the movie all day long, even when the cameras aren't rolling. And that was a very immersive experience that I wound up enjoying immensely and found incredibly exhilarating, like nothing else I've ever done. And part of that is because of all of the work that goes into making the scene before the camera rolls and the aftermath of the scene when the camera stops.
You touch on something in the book about those times that I think is really interesting, that you did this on Curb and you did this with Borat and the projects that you worked with, Sasha, this idea of improvisational directing. One thing to do it in front of the camera, another to do it behind the camera. I'm interested in your idea of what makes that work, of what allows the situation to seem and to be as natural while you are still having some control as to what is happening.
Well, I think the key phrase there is some.
Yeah.
Some control. And that's exactly what I was looking for. I wasn't interested in like a Hitchcockian sort of style of directing where every scene is kind of storyboarded and he almost doesn't have to show up, Hitchcock, because he's already kind of made the movie on paper and the technicians just need to follow that diagram. I am more of someone who wants to discover. I don't want to know. I would often say to actors, I don't want to know what's going to happen. You know, I want to be surprised. And so on both Curb and on, especially with the Sasha movies, I didn't want to know all the answers and you couldn't know all the answers. And that was kind of the beauty of Borat or Bruno is that you didn't know the answers going in. You didn't know where this scene was going to end. You didn't know what was going to happen, if it would work or not. And I love that idea of walking that tightrope with every scene. And sometimes it didn't work and we would have to do it all over again. Sometimes in a different city with different people, there's no take two, you know. And at the same time, when it did work, which was more often than not, it transcended my expectations for the scene. And artistically, that was an incredibly fulfilling experience.
And then you go on to do Religious with Bill Maher, and a documentary. Obviously, it is comedic, but he certainly has a point of view on this, and it must have been interesting because, I mean, you know what you're up against from the very beginning of how many people are going to react to it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the good thing, you know, we had talked after we did Borat, we had an idea of, like, you know, Fox wanted us to at least consider doing a sequel. At that time, Sasha was aghast at the idea of doing a sequel, and there was we were not going to do a sequel, but we did have one conversation, and in that conversation, I did suggest that Borat finds a new religion, and Sasha wasn't interested in doing that. He wasn't interested in doing a sequel at that time. And so, but I love the idea of like the religion. I love the idea of doing something with religion. And also being a movie freak and a TV freak all my life, I knew all the religious movies really, really well. I'd watched every religious movie over and over and over again as a kid. And I really had a strong sense of the ones that were, you know, beautiful and spiritual and the ones that were cheesy and funny. And I thought, yeah, there's a funny movie in using pop culture references to satire, to make a satire about religion. Then I was told, when I told my agents that idea, they said, well, you know, Bill Maher is also working on a religious satire. He's been writing something. So we met. And when we met, our two ideas kind of meshed together perfectly. You know, he had written these essays about religious hypocrisy. I had all these ideas about how to frame those things and use these clips to sort of undercut and use them for humor. And together we were able to kind of very organically and with a lot of fun, which I think again comes through in that movie like it does in Borat, with great fun, we were able to go out and kind of shoot this movie. And it was very, very loose. We had a great time. And then we were able to kind of assemble it in editing to make it the movie that it eventually became.
when you in working on the Borat movies and then Bruno and Dictator, I'm interested in the idea of a relationship and working with somebody who obviously is brilliant, but it's also very intense. And there were times, I think, after the first film, you didn't think you would ever be, you know, ever work with them again, and then you do, and then you do again. And of how those relationships evolve and change, because you're really one of the few people who can do what they want you to do.
Yeah, I think that, being from the streets of Brooklyn, I had a unique background to shoot a movie like Borat. I wasn't really afraid of people getting angry at me. I had people angry at me my whole life. You know, I wasn't afraid of confrontation. I didn't seek confrontation, but I knew how to navigate confrontation. And that was a kind of a key, and I had a kind of a desire for action and exhilaration that also is not necessarily a directorial trait. So I was kind of uniquely qualified for Borat. And Sasha and I just, you know, we just were like two peas in a pod. We were like brothers. I felt very close to him. And success, of course, breeds great camaraderie as well, you know. By the time Bruno came around, it was a very different experience. Sasha and I were still close, but the character of Bruno immediately created a different perception in the terms of the targets that we dealt with than Borat had. Borat might have been a misogynist, a rapist, an anti-Semite, but he was innocent on some level, and people gave him a lot of slack. They were very patient with him. When Bruno came along, people were ready for conflict. People were ready for violent confrontation. People were ready to be physical with him, and it created a much more tense environment to shoot the movie. I think I say in the book that Borat was on some level about love, and Bruno was on some level about hate. And it really kind of illustrated the hate that is under the surface of not just in America, but around the world, especially towards gay people. So I think that tension, the response to the movie, which wasn't quite the same response as we had had with Borat, I think just in the same way that success breeds this camaraderie, failure also sends everyone scurrying away from each other. And that was the end result of Bruno to some degree, even though I'm very proud of Bruno, and I think Sasha is too. I think it's in many ways a more radical work and a more difficult work. But then when we did The Dictator, things had even changed a lot more. Sasha had gotten more into the, you know, being part of Hollywood, and he was now a star. He was connected to a lot of the comedy people in the community. And the end result, in my opinion, was he became less trusting of his own instinct and sought counsel from exterior sources. And I think that kind of changed his sensibility to some degree. He became much more uncertain about the comedy. And I think in some ways that created some conflict in The Dictator.
When you think of the Larry Charles dangerous world of comedy, which you write about as well, so where does a comedy samurai go now?
Well, that's a good question. I think one of the places that I want to go, and I've been trying to go the last couple of years, is outside the mainstream. The studio system, the system in general, has kind of, I think, you know, run its course to a large degree. And I find that, you know, the meetings and the notes, it's soul crushing at a certain point. So I'm looking for projects and trying to generate projects that can be done outside of the system, you know, maybe going directly to YouTube or whatever it might be. The people that I interviewed on Dangerous Comedy, that was something that was very inspiring to me. They would use their phones in countries like Liberia or Nigeria, and they would just shoot something and they'd put it on social media. And there was no studio system. There was no network system. They were able to go directly to the audience. And that really appealed to me because there's no filter and no censorship. So that's one of the places that I would like to go, I think, and have gone and want to do more of.
And finally, I mean, you say in the book, and this is in the last chapter, but you were talking about the last day of February 2022 was the last time you spoke to Larry David. How do you look at that of someone that was instrumental in your career, and then how that ends?
Well, who knows if it's, you know, ending is a big word. You know, everything ends,
right?
You know, in a way. I mean, let you know, life ends. Life is temporary. Nothing is definite. And I think a lot of the illusions that I sort of labored under during my earlier life have been shattered in a good way. You know, it's like I see things much more honestly and truthfully now. I'm not as seduced by the illusion. And I have lots of friends who we've drifted apart for one reason or another, some good reasons, some bad reasons, some anger, some just the nature of how life progresses. And I think with Larry, it's sort of in that category. We just, we had been drifting apart for a long time before that. Our needs for each other had sort of lessened. Other things became priorities. Things shifted in a lot of ways. And so we had been drifting prior to that. And then that became kind of a crossroads moment where it just, you know, there wasn't any place to go. There wasn't any place to move forward on that. And I think we both have pretty full lives and have sort of like just kind of gone in those different directions. And I don't think it's necessarily a sign. I do love him. I'd never be able to thank him enough for all the things he's done for me. But I don't feel a need to hang out with him or really talk to him. And I don't think he feels that either. And I think that's okay. That is the nature of things to a large degree. And you regret those things, but you can be sad about those things, but you also honor that sadness. I think that's what's important.
In closing, it just seems that when you have that kind of relationship and it's so close and it's so intense and it's for a lengthy period of time, inevitably there are going to be bumps or maybe even a dissolution that must happen to allow everyone to go on in the right direction.
I think you're right. I mean, there are all kinds of theories about that in psychology, like the Oedipal theory, you know. I think that, you know, it was kind of like an inevitability. We were so close and our relationship was so intense that it had reached a certain pinnacle and it had to like sort of dissipate on some level for our sanity. And the documentary was the catalyst for that.
The name of the new book is Comedy Samurai, 40 Years of Blood, Guts, and Laughter, a memoir by Larry Charles. It is published by Grand Central. Larry, what a delight. I'm a big fan of your work. I thank you so much for taking the time for being with us.
Thank you, my friend. It was great to be here. Pleasure to meet you.
Thank you very much. Be well. Again, the name of the book is Comedy Samurai, 40 Years of Blood, Guts, and Laughter, a memoir. The book is published by Grand Central. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.